Welcome to another episode of Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I'm your host. It's great to be with you. We are going to be talking about an article that came out in American Reformer on fortresses. We're not talking about trebuchets and that kind of thing, although we could probably get into that with these two guys. But we're talking about what Christians need to think about today, and I think it was kind of inspired by Aaron Wren's new book. And so I've got the authors of the article on the show, two guests. I think this is the first time in the history of the pod that we've had two guests at the same time, so we'll see how this goes. Maybe the last time, depending on it. But I wanted to have them introduce themselves. I've got Timon and Clifford. Both have been guests on the show before, and both of them, since they've been guests, have had some recent moves into either new locations, new jobs. And so I wanted to have them kind of introduce themselves once again to the audience. So Clifford, why don't you give us kind of an update on where you're at and what you're doing?
Sure. Last time I was on this podcast, I think I was in Alabama. I am now in Tallahassee, Florida, where I work at the Florida Department of Education in the Florida College System as the executive vice chancellor, kind of over academic and student affairs. I should note, of course, everything I say here is my own opinion. I don't reflect the opinions of the department or the division. And I am still
no position on fortresses.
That's right. I'm still affiliated with the Edmund Burke Foundation as the director of religious coalitions, doing a little bit of work there too. So, yeah, but that's where I'm at now.
Excellent. And Clifford, I have to ask, does that make you Ben Sasse's boss or no?
No.
Good to know.
I'm in the college system, the university system, completely separate. So.
Oh, okay, cool. Good to know.
But if he was,
quite unfortunate.
The answer is yes. If he was in the university system.
Yes. That's
right. Then we've got Timon on the show. Timon, you have a lot of different ventures you're part of, the Hill Institute, but why don't you kind of give people kind of a rundown?
Yeah, so I'm editor-in-chief of American Reformer, director of scholarly initiatives at Hale, the Hale Institute, which is New St. Andrews College. What else did I do? I write still at different places, supposed to write regularly at World. I think that covers it. That's all, everything I'm doing.
Are you still at Westminster doing stuff with Westminster?
Oh, yeah, I'm still a fellow at the Craig Center at Westminster, still working on some academic research there. The main thing I'm working on now is writing an introduction for the first volume of Anthony Burgess's collected works that are coming out probably in like a year or two, but his work on natural law, his lectures. So that's part of that work. Yeah.
Excellent. And you can also find Time in Substack. He publishes about once a year on his Substack, and a recent article was over there today. So make sure you check out his Substack for free. He could be publishing at all these other institutions, but he's putting out his content for free to the masses.
On Substack. I think I dedicated my whatever I wrote last April to you, Chase, for that reason.
You did. You did. It was fantastic. I was so pumped. All right. Well, let's get into this article on fortresses. So this was kind of riffing off Aaron Wren's latest book, Life in the Negative World. To start off the article, and I'll put a link for the listener in the show notes. We're not going to do a read through or anything like that. But you highlight kind of two examples. We've got culture warriors and cultural engagers. So I wanted to get maybe for the audience some more language on that and definitions on that. Because there's a lot of stuff today where people would accuse either me or others of culture warring. You've got cultural engagement being kind of a huge movement in evangelicalism led by people like Tim Keller. And yet in the article, you say they both get something wrong. So I wanted to hear from you guys. What do they get wrong?
Yeah. You want me to take a...
Well, I'll
there you go. Go ahead, Cliff.
Okay. So
that's why you have two guests.
I think it's Chase. Important. That's right. So culture warring, I think, didn't even have a term until really the cultural engagement period. And that's when they sort of looked back and said, what you guys were doing is you're trying to take back the whole country. You're trying to influence the entire American culture. And that was a strategy that made sense in what we now looking back consider to be the positive world. When as Aaron says in his book, you could reasonably assume a majority Christian country. And so it seemed to make sense. Well, if we've got a majority of Christians here, we ought to be able to turn the culture around. And as we entered into the neutral world, I think people looked back and said, wow, that was a really kind of violent attempt. You were trying to take DC and then through DC influence the entire country. And then the cultural engagement strategy, this is where I think is really important for us to understand, because it's the cultural insurgency that we're, that Aaron presents and we're elaborating on is best understood in contradistinction, I think, to cultural engagement, which itself understood itself as different from cultural warring, which is this much more, as we say in the article, assumes a kind of marketplace neutral mentality where Christians are given an equal seat at the table to share their ideas and to try and win people through rhetoric and that kind of a thing. And so it's critical if you want to understand what cultural insurgency is, you have to understand what cultural engagement is. And if you want to understand what cultural engagement, as they understood people who were involved in that, as they understood themselves, you have to understand what they thought they were responding to, which is the culture warriors. And I think this is really critical because there's a lot of people who are still convinced that we are in what Aaron calls the neutral world, which calls for a cultural engagement strategy. So if you are convinced by his logic that we are no longer in that world, then it makes sense to consider, well, what strategy do we need to abandon and what strategy do we need to pick up? And so the cultural insurgency is the strategy that makes sense in the era that we're in now that we consider the negative world.
Okay, yeah, Timon, so what is cultural insurgency? Yeah, go ahead.
Just add one thing. I mean, just to orient people, you mentioned Tim Keller. That's perfect for cultural engagement. And then, you know, if you want to think of cultural warriors, Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, like, the, you know, that helps people kind of stick in their minds the historical period, kind of what was going on and who you're thinking. Because a lot of it, I think Aaron is describing is disposition and personality. And we're just taking these categories right from Aaron's book. So it's kind of the posture you have towards the outside world or towards the culture. Obviously, it's in the label of each. And then the way Cliff, you know, described the rest, I think, is perfect. And we said, you know, the mistake of each and why you need something for the negative world. It's not just that the negative world is here, so the conditions have changed, although that's the main point. The other point is that probably both approaches were always flawed in a sense. One is that the culture engagers, because Aaron is very clear that even positive world, quote unquote, is a period kind of marking the beginning of decline, right? So I think James Hudson, it's Winthrop Hudson, in his book on American Protestantism, very short and accessible. People should read it, from like the 1950s. And he marks like 1914 as a turning point, which Aaron would now, he would use the phrase, that's when like positive world begins, but you're declining. And so our point was, extrapolating from Aaron, is that the culture warriors, their scope was too large. In a sense, it's to take, as Cliff said, to take the whole culture all at once, meet them on the field, this sort of thing. And you're already in decline, which means you don't actually, you are at a beginning stage of lacking the technology and the troops to actually meet them in open combat. And then the culture engagers, their scope is probably sufficiently shrunk in a sense that they just don't have the same ambitions, but they don't recognize that they're in a state of war. They think it's sort of this marketplace of ideas that's fair play. We all play by the rules and we will garner the currency of the day, which is, you know, the currency is respect and esteem and sort of position and all these things. And that's why you see this in the makeup, as people have documented, of Tim Keller's church, which is a lot of cosmopolitan, multicultural people in white collar jobs, you know, because that's kind of the respectable positions. And through amassing enough of those people, you're going to start to incrementally engage the culture, you know, for Christ. I mean, the ambition, the root ambition is not bad. It's just whether the strategy holds up. So those are the two critiques we had and why you need something new.
Okay. And Clifford, was cultural insurgency, this is a term is from Wren's book, and I'm hoping to get Wren scheduled on the pod to get into his book. So this will give me plenty of information on it, but cultural insurgency is one coined and advocated by him. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I'm not sure if it appears in the book. We came across it when we were listening to, it's not, yeah, it's actually in two talks that he gave last year. You could tell he was still kind of thinking through the implications of this kind of framework. two different talks that he gave that were pretty similar, and he uses this term cultural insurgency. And so in his book, though, I think it's critical to note, he does say the kind of posture that Christians need to have is a self-understanding as a minority presence. It doesn't necessarily mean population, but it just means cultural influence and power. We are a minority, and until we understand that fact, we're not going to operate well in the circumstances that prevail today. So, yeah, that term is from Aaron. It's not in the book, but the concept of what does it mean to operate as a minority, that is in the book for sure.
And we, okay, and then Aaron, two did, things that Aaron kind of come out recently of, write oh, a, in his newsletter, I think a little, maybe earlier this week of recording or a week ago. And then we republished it in American Reformer just because it's pertinent to the, but he did start writing up this idea, which is, you know, sort of a addendum to the book in many ways. And he goes through, you know, you can take it straight from the horse's mouth there, but we picked it up from, like Cliff said, these two lectures he gave that were part of bigger presentations of the book. And, you know, we found stuff in there to grab onto. So it's consistent with the book. It's just kind of stuff that was developed, I think, after he had written it, basically.
Okay. So with cultural insurgency, what we're talking about, I mean, first of all, that, you know, growing up in post 9/11 America, I typically associate the word insurgent as bad. And so you're going to have to maybe help some people in the audience go like, well, that doesn't seem like a term I would want to use. So why do you find it to be a useful term to describe kind of the position of Christians in America today? Whoever wants to take that on, go for it.
You want me to do it, Cliff? Okay. Yeah,
go
sure.
For it.
The, yeah, I mean, one, we are just taking what Aaron said, so we can blame Aaron if it's a bad word to use. But we think it's a good one because, one, it is, I mean, he writes in his piece that just recently came out, it's in his talk, he's drawing a lot of his concepts, you know, obviously translated to a cultural context, but a lot of his concepts are from this book he read on called Fourth Generation Warfare. That's about, you know, essentially guerrilla and insurgency warfare and how stuff is changing. At the time, I think it was written in the 90s or something. So that's where he gets, you know, the term applies cultural to it. And the point is though, that, you know, it acknowledges the reality of Christians in a negative world. And so I think one illustration Aaron himself has given is, you know, in the scope of history, this was your country, predominantly Christian and Protestant. You've lost power. You should think of yourself as like if you had an invading, occupying force. It may be that you're still numerically the majority, but you're now embattled and no longer hold the levers of power. And so, you know, what would you resort to if this was real warfare? You would have to resort to some kind of guerrilla insurgency in order to reclaim anything that you've lost. But you don't have the ability at present, the sort of foothold to launch open warfare in kind with your occupiers. And so it's the metaphor of warfare that he's bringing in, which to accommodate the sort of more aggressive and embattled position we are in negative world.
Okay, great. That's really helpful. So with this cultural insurgency, two of the topics you guys highlight are shifting loyalties and owned space. I've thought a lot about owned space, particularly with, you know, being in a more hostile climate, progressive city, and how important that is for Christians to have ownership. So I'm thinking very literally when I hear that about buildings and that kind of thing. But maybe for the audience, tease out what you mean by shifting loyalties and owned space. Clifford, if you want to tackle a little bit of that first and then hear from Timon on it as well.
Yeah. The shifting loyalties one is I think it's more complicated of the two because it requires making a distinction that Americans aren't used to making, which is a distinction between the nation understood as the people, the folkways, the traditional, the thing which was taken over by a foreign force in our metaphor that we're talking about. And so a distinction between that thing and the ruling regime, the people who are in power, who are enforcing the rule right now. And it's saying you need to shift your loyalties to the nation and understand how that's different from the levers of power. And the easiest way to understand it is with the military. There are a lot of people now who have legacy military families, and they're used to sending their young men to fight in wars for the country. And now for the first time, they're having to reconsider that. Why is that? What's the logic that they're thinking through? What they end up with, if they decide, I actually can't in good faith recommend that my son go into the U.S. military anymore. They've made that distinction between the thing for which they would die, the country, the nation itself, and the people who are sending them out and the causes for which they'd be sent out that they may not believe serve the interests of the nation. So that's the first one, that shifting loyalties. Try to see in what different ways does that distinction apply. And then the one of owned space,
while we're in shifting loyalty, can we take shifting loyalties?
Yeah.
And then move over to the other one. Just real quick to add to that. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And that's how, and Aaron, you know, describes a bit of this in his own way, but we, you know, again, like Cliff said, it's very difficult for Americans to separate essentially the government, the apparatus, the structure, which we're saying in this metaphor has been conquered, right? It's now used at least in some ways counter to your own interests. And in that sense, in this provisional sense, it's hostile to you, right? And so the military is a good one where the predominant people that fill the military roles to go get killed are, you know, white Appalachian and Midwestern young guys, right? Like that's who goes and gets killed historically. Regular kind of Americans, grill Americans. And they're the ones now that are most demonized, you know, by the regime. They're the ones that, you know, the military's sort of recruitment strategies and even the CIA and these things are to get, you know, I remember that CIA commercial like a year ago that was promoting, like the person speaking, I work for the CIA. She's like, I have like gender dysphoria and like anxiety and all this. And like, this is the girl you're going to give a drone to. It's like, what is going on? This is insane. So they're no longer appealing to the people that actually, you know, are kind of sacrificing for it. They're no longer interested in spreading sort of Americanism as we used to understand it. It's now, you know, rainbow Americanism. It's rainbow flags at the State Department and at the embassies around the world. So recognizing this, you know, that's one piece, but we'd say it's the entire apparatus is now in general and in most ways no longer aligned with the nation as we're conceiving it. The majority of the people, certainly the Christian nation, historically understood. And so you need to understand that in an instance when we're not talking about violence, but in certain instances, you need to start shifting your loyalty to the people that the government is really supposed to, you know, be structured around and conducive to their flourishing. And in the sense that it's not doing that in the ways we're talking about, it's no longer deserving of your undying, unquestioned loyalty. You need to, where you can, shift your time and resources and loyalties elsewhere. And a lot of this is going to take a more localist flair.
And let me just add a point that – so this whole thing, one of the criticisms that we've received is, well, where are the Bible verses supporting what you guys are saying? And I'm just going to say – I'm going to claim Matthew 10:16, where Jesus advises us to be innocent as doves and as wise as serpents. And so we're trying to help the people of God be wise as serpents here. And so on this point, it occurred to me that the left has understood this principle for a long time, which is why we have this idea of the deep state. So we elect people into the powers of government, and the people who work in that apparatus don't see, or their loyalty is rather to their principles more so than to whoever is their boss, whoever was put in those positions of power by the American people. They would say, no, I don't care what those people are telling me. My loyalty is to this other thing. So the left understands these principles better than the right does, generally speaking. And so this is something that people that Christians need to understand as well.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into own space then. What counts as own space, or how are we defining own space? Clifford, why don't you go?
Yeah. So in this essay, you'll see we have a lot of quotations from Machiavelli, because this, when it comes down to being as wise as a serpent, he does that pretty well. And so one of his most fundamental concepts is not relying on the arms of others. And so that principle, it's been reinterpreted in many different ways throughout the, you know, in the article we cite, you know, Michael Anton and Bronze Age Pervert and all those guys. And those, you know, we don't have to endorse those guys or even say that they originated this term, but that the coinage of that term, own space, is really that principle that goes back to Machiavelli, which is really you cannot rely on people who are not under your control, if you're, especially if you're in this situation that we are, that we find ourselves in. And so the principle has very broad application. It can mean something as much as physical space. And I think it has to mean that in a fun, you have to understand the importance of owning physical space, because we have bodies. The incarnation puts us in physical space, but it also can apply digitally. It can apply in different ways. Culturally, is this a space that's dominated? And it's funny, you can look at something like humor. You know, what are the jokes that you're allowed to make? You can kind of tell who owns the cultural space there by the things that people are allowed to laugh at. And that'll differ from place to place and environment from environment. So people have to understand, if they want to be able to operate well in the negative world, in pockets. And that's the whole strategy of the insurgency, is you're not going to be able to take over the entire country, but you can focus on trying to take pockets. And how do you do that? Well, you have to start owning pockets and owning strategic places in those areas that give you a foothold where you can establish schools, churches, families, and preserve human flourishing as we understand it best.
Timon, what would you add to that? Anything?
Yeah, just to, we did use Bronze Age pervert, and there's portions of Bronze Age mindset that we couldn't quote because they're a little too colorful that are on this theme. But it is a fascinating, the only thing I'd add to what Clifford is saying is just further texture in that sense of when he discusses this theme all over the place. It's kind of woven in throughout at least a major portion of the book. And that's why Anton pulls it out. And then that's why Ren pulled it from Anton, is kind of one of the central themes. But he just describes these kind of like, if you're in one sense, you can think of yourself as an animal in captivity. In another sense, you could think of yourself in a sort of foreign country where, you know, you don't know the landscape anymore. You don't know the map. You don't know instinctually, like through memory as a child, the creek beds and, you know, this, it's not familiar to you. And what we pulled from that is also something from Machiavelli, where he's like, you know, even in peacetime, which we would say positive world was kind of like peacetime, neutral world the same. What evangelicals didn't do is acquaint themselves in peacetime with both strategy and the landscape and exercise those muscles for warfare, because it's coming. And Machiavelli, you know, impresses upon the prince that when it's in peacetime, you need to be studying maps, both the paper and walk, kind of like walking the land, like surveying it, so that if you're attacked, you would know exactly what strategies to implement. And we just don't know the landscape anymore, and we don't own it anymore. It's not familiar. And so the point is to sort of recapture pieces of it that become very easy for you to operate in, because it's yours. You know it. It's your land. No one else could wage warfare there effectively against you, because they don't know the land and you do. But that's something we've lost. So I think that's a part of like the idea that it gives people a mental picture. Think of landscape also. So it's physical ownership, but then just kind of your places, you're familiar with it, rather than on borrowed places or unchosen battlefields. And that's something both in the positive and neutral world evangelicals did not do. They did not choose the field well in a place that was familiar to them.
And if I could add one more thought on that, just thinking of your audience, particularly Chase, I think Christians, you know, we live in the tension of the now and the not yet, and we're citizens of the kingdom of God, but we're also living in as citizens in this world. And that's a hard place to live, in that tension. So it's understandable that we would have this trouble. But I think part of the reason that Christians really struggle with thinking through this is they're used to thinking in terms of principles and absolutes, and not having to take consideration of the particular and the circumstances that we're in right now. They just want to be able to focus on the eternal things. And obviously scripture commends us all over the place that that's where our primary focus is. But we also have to live faithfully in this world, in these places, in these times. We didn't choose these times or these places. This is where in the providence of God we find ourselves. And we have to act faithfully to the duties that we're called to live at all times and in all places. And here's where we are and where we find ourselves. So I think it beckons Christians to have a perspective change, to say, And if you look at the way we build our churches, right? If we're just renting spaces, if we're just building little warehouses that can be torn down, you know, rather than building cathedrals and or structures that have beauty and integrity and structure to them that are made to last a long time, to where multiple generations of families can have lived and died, it's just a very different perspective. And so, how did we end up in the place we're at? Part of it has to do with we took our focus completely off of the circumstances that we're in, and we put them completely up. And so, again, I understand that this is really difficult, and it's a tension. And the problem is, if you try and resolve it too much by focusing too much on the ground, and you lose your perspective of the eternal, you're in trouble. But I think what we have to realize is that if you put your perspective 100% on the eternal, you're not able to operate well as a Christian in the body that we live in this world. So trying to help Christians think through that is really difficult, but we're hoping that these tools help people think through that.
Absolutely. With there's kind of two illustrations that come to mind. One, something I've been thinking about a lot is, I don't know if y'all listen to Jocko Willink, but I listen to him every once in a while. But he was famous for the Battle of Ramadi. And in the Battle of Ramadi, the Navy SEALs went in and they took one block, and it was an insurgent stronghold, and they just owned that block. And bit by bit, they expanded out. And that's been an analogy that I've used in my teaching amongst other pastors and that kind of thing. Kind of a, y'all use the phrase cultural insurgency. Fair enough. It might even be something where you could call it a cultural counterinsurgency, because, you know, Christians must assume the center. We must assume, because we do, we believe God's ways are best for all people. And in that way, God's ways are the norm. They are the normal way that the world is designed to operate. And anyone who deviates from God's ways is an insurgent against the living God, a traitor, committing treason. And so I just think that's a really interesting way to think about it, particularly as you use own space. How can Christians think about entering into places that are hostile, and they know they're hostile? The other analogy I thought of was, you know, back in 2020, when a lot of this was hitting our front door, and how we were dealing with it with people in our church. I used to be able to recommend Gospel Coalition articles or other networks or other thinkers in Christianity, and the guns were silent. We were calling for air support, and there was nothing. And in fact, many times they were giving their arms to the enemy. They were actually trying to advocate for their purposes. And so I think going back to shifting loyalties and own space, using that Machiavellian principle of, you know, don't rely on foreign arms, I think a lot of us were caught off guard that the ruling evangelical elite particularly were willing to give arms, almost like when we withdrew from Afghanistan. They were willing to totally just give arms to the enemy, you know, but they were not willing to support the people on the ground in the hard places. So I think this is just a really helpful way to think about that. You guys home in on an analogy of a fortress. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. Why do you think a fortress is an apt metaphor for what we need today? You say in the article, the initial phase of reinforcement of the evangelical position must be dedicated to anti-fragility, insulation, protection from external threats, upgrade to a fortress, solidify your position, and with time, you can launch from a place of strength. Again, the long-term goal is not monkish withdrawal, but conquest. So, you know, the question I'm wrestling with in this is like, okay, fortress seems cool. It appeals to my masculine sensibilities. Why is it an apt metaphor? And then what counts as a fortress when we're thinking about that?
Go for it, Timon.
Okay, I was going to tell you too. I think actually, so this is the background is that me and Cliff conjured this up on a long car ride several weeks ago, or like a month ago. And this is basically, now everyone has an insight into how we intellectually handle things. There's all these different analogies. Like in this one, we're using, you know, map games that guys play and stuff. Anyway, so I think Cliff actually came up with fortress as being the thing. You know, you need something tangible. Yes, it needs to be martial in spirit, because it's negative world, it's warfare, and that it's also masculine is good too, because that's part of the whole thing. So the idea of the fortress is, you know, it does matter that we use the map games, you know, Civilization, Total War, Age of Empires, these types of games. There's sort of a progression in your technology and through your resources and cultural reach to what kind of structures you can erect, right? You begin with usually some kind of totally indefensible little settlement, And the next stage to shore up your position is a defensive structure like a fortress. You can't own a massive town or a city until you kind of go through this process. It's a very typical, you know, progression in these types of games. So we're like, that's basically where we're at, or what we should aspire to be. Most of our places right now are these dilapidated little towns that either were formerly great, or they're brand new and they're just very weak. What we need to aspire to is the next step, which is a defensive structure that can handle attacks, because that's the position we're in. But also can be a base, you know, to launch forward from, but you always are kind of retreating. You know, you can, Josh Abitoy, our, you know, director, said, we, you know, included in this for him is you can launch raiding parties out, but you can always retreat back to the fortress, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's your place. And you want to do that to test the defenses of the enemies and to maybe gain new resources. But basically you want this stronghold. And within the stronghold, you know, medieval fortresses had semblances of social and economic life within them. It's not, you know, this totally, it's not a barracks, not just totally a barracks, but it's a very purposefully defensive structure. And it's not what you think of as a city. We're not capable of taking over the cities. We're not capable of building one yet. So the idea, though, is a fortress translated into this cultural situation is, you know, we thought of several examples and we list some of them in the piece. But, you know, it's trying to develop one thing that is kind of an own space, an area of life that is necessary for a bigger Christian life, but it's something we've lost. So you mentioned TGC. It's like media. Where's the Christian media that is reliable, that's committed to the nation, our interest to Christians, and that is anti-fragile? It's not relying on others for their resources. It's secure and it's reliable. That's a fortress. If you, a town or a city is going to be a multiplicity of industries and practices and activities from Christians, where, and it's all together, right? But right now we just have to focus on erecting these sort of insular even fortresses. And the idea, you know, the New Christendom Press guys kind of, they announced their conference like right when we were publishing this, and it works perfectly, where they're using boroughs, you know, in a sort of Alfred the Great strategy. It's the same, it's interchangeable. They have the same idea, I think, in many ways, although they haven't expounded on it. And so our idea was, you're going to build these fortresses, media over here, let's say businesses can be a type of fortress, and then it becomes a network and you have communication, you know, and you can kind of be relying on each other for the distinct and unique thing this fortress does. It's needed for the people in this one too. And you can begin to, you know, claim a certain sort of area and have a, you know, a perimeter set up in a certain way. And maybe one day through a combination of efforts, you can begin to build, you know, a city, something larger, and that's a little more open, a little more confident, you know, these sorts of things.
So I'll start to answer your second question, I think, Chase, which was, what are some examples? What does it look like? Right. So, Timon gave a good example, a good description of it. What it's a sort of a middle thing between a fledgling, very vulnerable kind of organization or institution and a strong, uncancelable city, right? And the two examples we point to in the article are Moscow, Idaho, and Hillsdale College. Both of those communities are going to be very difficult to dislodge. So most of us should aspire to something in the middle. So a couple examples. One I thought of is American Reformer. That is has become a really important forum for sharing ideas digitally. And if you notice, they don't have ads popping up all over the place like you would see on, I won't name some examples, but there are others. They make it a little hard to read, but the models for them are completely dependent on their advertisers. And we've seen the story how many times when people who are very dependent on advertisers, and the advertiser says, I don't like what you said in that piece, you better take that down or I'm going to pull my, and then, you know, then, so that's an example of not owning space. So American Reformer has generous supporters and donors, and they're always looking for more. And so that allows them to be able to speak really from a strong position, this defensible place. So that's an example of a digital one. One that's an example that I think is really important, one that a concept, a topic that American Reformer covers a lot is classical education. And I think that's a really interesting example because schools have become much more than just places where you send your kids to be educated. They're whole communities. And a lot of them, the classical schools I'm thinking of particularly, well, I've had the privilege of being able to teach and really interested in the network component of those schools. But the idea, the point though, is that that's an example of a physical institution. And it's not one that it operates very different from market forces. So I'm sure there are some people who send their children to the classical school because when they added up the pros and the cons, it gives them the best, you know, bang for the buck and for what they want, which is to get their kid maybe to an Ivy League school or something like that. But I think most people do not send their kids there for that purpose. They're operating on a sense of loyalty. In other words, they send their kids there for reasons other than maximizing, you know, cost benefit analysis. There are relationships there, and there's a vision of the good life that, to which they are loyal. And that institution is something that is much more defensible than, people who are maybe homeschooling out by themselves, completely isolated, like my family was when I was growing up in the 90s, where there wasn't a whole lot of options for people. And you're just in a very vulnerable situation there. So the classical schools provide a physical, tangible thing that you can shift your loyalties to, right? That's not a marketplace kind of decision. Those bring together families who would otherwise be isolated. So that's an example in my mind of a fortress. And it's why if you have one of those in your community, it is worth pouring your life into, whether that means supporting with financially or getting on the board or something like that, recognizing the importance of those institutions for a larger community. I didn't even have to say churches, because obviously that's the obvious one in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cliff's mentioning classical education, classical schools, many of which, and I think this is a good model if it's workable, are attached to a church, right? That's strengthening one of one another in a very easy, like almost pre-existing network kind of fashion, assuming it's workable. It's not everywhere.
Upgraded technology. That. Yeah.
Yes. Upgraded technology. The other one would be, I would say, and Cliff mentioned this in passing, and I wrote on this in a sense before this Fortress article a while back, a classical school could be really, really strong and productive and be anti-fragile in a sense, but it can only be, it in some senses maintains weaknesses because if it remains detached from or there's no options of fortress colleges that exist. Because everyone knows that you can be really dedicated to a solid Christian confessional, you know, particularized class, but your kid's got to go to college. Like that's, and most of people going that care about education want them to, even if it's not, you know, for a profession. But where do they go? So then you're concerned, in a sense, relying upon conforming to standards that get your children to the next level. If you have colleges that are acting as fortresses, that problem is solved. The next step after that is employment. Even if you're a really solid college, we know Hillsdale, New St. Andrews, many of these schools, I think there's a handful of them that are solid. They're doing everything they do because they love it, but you still in the back of your mind are always thinking about like, what are our graduates going to do when they leave? That's part of a sign of success. So then you need businesses that complete in this sort of pipeline or network connected by roads, you know, in that Alfred analogy, to make all of these, you know, even stronger and be able to do what they do with in some sense impunity towards the regime and for the good of the nation and for Christians and for their constituting purpose. You know, we want schools to do what they're supposed to do really, really well. But all of this is interconnected. And so that's sort of the idea as well, is as you develop these fortresses, they do, they are in some sense, if you don't want to be relying on the regime, you need to have the next step or kind of your flanks protected by other fortresses as well, so that your position becomes solidified. And one day, you know, if you ever want to inaugurate another more positive world where it's more comfortable and favorable to you, you're going to have to be able to launch from a position of strength at some point. And so you've got to shore up these kind of vacancies in the meantime.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm glad we talked about businesses and churches, because those are the things that, you know, immediately come to my mind for people looking for work, for people looking for worship. And, obviously, I try not to be too biased, but, you know, the church is kind of a big deal. And I think it's crucial that churches own space and and really stop depending on the arms of others, so to speak. I know, Clifford, we've only got a few more minutes with you. I've got about
10 minutes, so we're good.
Okay.
If I could riff off just one comment you made there, which is a way of thinking about this is it used to be you're a Christian, you have a church you're loyal to, but when you need a plumber, you're going to go in the marketplace and you're going to try and find the best plumber there. And you may still have to do that. But if in the fortress mindset, it means you go and ask, is there a plumber in your church? Is there a plumber connected to your school? You go there first. And so your loyalty, again, shifting loyalty, you're asking, how can I work within the network that I have here? And so you're not saying, well, I'll pick this person, if he proves better than some other person in the marketplace. So this is a really practical, it's not an abstract thing. Everyone can operate this way and start thinking through how this is going to change their life right now. So I just wanted to add that to what you were saying.
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, even in our own church building, that's something like we kept going like, well, we have a sub that, you know, as a Christian, can we hire them? And they're like, sure. You know, so like we're constantly trying to think like, how can we have a ecosystem of that?
Well, and two things on this point, referring to kind of like the, could be in a church context or a school context, private context, when you're looking at necessary outside contacts, right? Like unless you have a plumber on staff at your church, Chase, maybe you do because your construction background. I don't know if you just employ these people, but you know, they're outside. Maybe they're a person that goes to your church, but they're not in, you know, as part of the church staff or something. Giving that kind of preferential treatment in a way is something that other groups in America, especially religious minorities, have done for decades and decades and decades. Jews do this really well. Like if you've up in the Northeast, there are very insular communities that are high functioning. They look nice. They're clean. And they do everything together, and they have no bones about it. They're totally fine doing this. In fact, they think it's proper. So thinking of yourself, we haven't had to think of ourselves in that regard in a long, long time, maybe in the history of our country. And so it's saying you kind of have to start thinking that way again, which other people have. The other point with churches in particular in own space, I think we've seen, you know, the importance of, and this is literal in space, the importance of it, for lots of churches through the COVID period and onward, and especially now with, you know, the current thing can get people's leases ripped up. They can be pushed out, literally lose their buildings. The other point is like, we don't want this fate for ourselves, but look at how long a lot of mainline churches have continued to exist simply because they own the buildings. And there's like five people in them, and they're this great like Rockefeller-built building in downtown Manhattan that everyone would want, right? Prime real estate. And that's only because of own space. Now, we, of course, want to prioritize our souls and the health of our churches over that. And we want that to be the reason. But the point is the own space, literally owning it, is nothing to be snubbed. This is very important, and it can ensure a longevity that otherwise is not there. And as in many cases, churches have been in precarious positions recently. And again, we didn't have to worry about that for a long time because it was considered good to be a Christian. So if you're a commercial real estate guy and you have a church leasing a bowling alley, you're like, yeah, it's a good thing because it's neutral world or it's positive world. And, you know, I like those people. They're nice. Now, at bare minimum, they don't really care. You're not treated any differently. Or you may even be offensive to them if you're not flying the right rainbow flag or playing the green grocer part very well. So that's the difference now. And I think churches, in all seriousness, need to be very, very serious about getting their own space and then moving into assisting some of these other fortress building projects for young families, getting children into schools. These sorts of things need to be a focus of certainly the diaconal ministry.
Sure. Our church experienced that. I can put a link to the article from the Daily Wire about how our church got evicted because of things we were just preaching from the Bible on marriage and that kind of thing. And that business chose to part ways with us over it. So, because they were getting pressure. So this is real stuff that churches are facing in America. One thing that comes up into this with the kind of the fortress analogy is screening. You highlight Wilson's blog on that. I think this is interesting because the American church has been so captivated by kind of a version of hospitality, which is kind of borderless. There are no borders. It's almost like we've devalued borders. We've become more like a village where it's like, yeah, come and go, free market of ideas. And we've let in a lot of people who are not aligned, who are not with us. And I'm not even talking high standards. I'm not, when I say aligned, I'm not even saying like, you got to be listening to the podcast and all that kind of stuff. I'm just talking like basic Christian doctrine. And so why do you think screening is so important? And why do you think it will ruffle feathers? Because in my mind, it's like the opposite of like a Willow Creek model or a Big Eva model of kind of like, you know, anything short of sin to see someone saved. So talk me a little bit through screening and why that matters and how churches and how pastors can do that.
Yeah. With the fortress metaphor, you know, we identify, you know, in the medieval world and in the ancient world, if you're under siege, the biggest threat is somebody on the inside opening the gates to the enemy in the middle of the night. And so there's a great vulnerability on the inside. And so, that's the metaphor. What does it mean? Well, as we've seen, there's been a lot of people who in an effort to try and bring in, to try and persuade through a cultural engagement strategy, people who have come in and have tried to change the culture in ways that have diluted it from the gospel and you know, mission drift generally. So I think the reason this is difficult for people is this is where the rubber meets the road when it comes to shifting their thinking from cultural engagement to cultural insurgency. And I think all your listeners have to ask themselves, am I persuaded by Aaron's arguments that we are no longer in a neutral world? Do I buy the framework? And if I buy the framework, do I buy that we are now in a negative world? And if you're persuaded of that, I think the logic follows necessarily that you have to start being suspicious in ways that you didn't have to be before. And like you said, we all understood it as part of our Christian duty. And this is the difference between principle and prudence. Of course, we're called to be hospitable, and of course, we're called to preach the gospel. But if we look in history and if we look in scripture, we see that that doesn't always mean you're trying to be winsome and try and get people to like you. That's not always how it works. And so the idea of screening means you have to be careful about who you let in. And the way that you do that is that you're not afraid to, you know, if you're faithful in this world, in the negative world, if you are saying, if you're speaking truth, you're going to offend a lot of people. Some of them will say, I'm a Christian and I'm offended by what you're saying. I mean, how many times have you, Chase, had to deal with that? And what those people will do, is self-separate, right? They will distance themselves from you because you now have made a stand that if they are near you and associated with you, then they will be thrown under the bus by other people, and they don't want to do that. So but what we're saying is that can be a really healthy thing. That can be a really healthy thing. Now that's not a ticket to be a jerk, right?
Right.
No one's saying that, but it is a reality that, you know, you have to be very wary of people who can come in. And so it's just a different posture. It's one from saying, hey, you know, no walls, no boundaries. Everybody can kind of come and go, to saying, hey, this is a really precious and vulnerable thing behind me that I'm standing here protecting, and I need to vet you before you come in. So right. That's what it means.
There's also the flip side to this. So one, I think Cliff laid out the screening process well, which is very natural. You mentioned 9/11 earlier, Chase, and you guys are a lot older than me, but I do remember what it was like to fly before 9/11. What do you got? You guys are like 40 or something, right?
So 37.
37. Okay. One. Yeah. A lot older. No, but I, you know, if you remember, I mean, you used to be able to have like pocket knives on the plane and stuff, right? And screening overnight, and we still have to deal with it, right? Now it's like the butt of a joke. It's so annoying and pervasive. In a properly, you know, functioning society, we would be much stricter at the border. And that's a point of contention for that very reason. So it's very natural, especially once an external identifiable threat that has made its own kind of incursion into your place is recognized. You do this. It's just part of a natural. We do this in our own churches. I'm sure if you have, you know, people working with children have to get background checks, all this kind of thing. So very normal when you know that there are threats that exist in the world. And so making sure you're attracting the right people, again, not, you know, putting on kind of, you know, an a costume or something to be super scary, but just doing exactly what you're supposed to do in this environment will push away people that shouldn't be there. If you make it too seeker sensitive, which is part of the culture, the former models, you're going to get in some people that are probably going to undermine, we're not even talking about crime here, but just undermine your project. So you need to be careful in that way. The flip side of it is that we identify the piece is through that you're also going to attract all the right people, mm-hmm. because people are hungry for that, for actually the forthright, masculine, self-assertive, and like entrepreneurial spirit of like, we're building something, you know, come with us if you want to live. And I'll let Cliff get into that last section in a second, because that's really his idea. But it's people are attracted to that and looking for it, a sort of beacon. And, you know, Aaron identifies this as well, is like, that is effectively, whether designed this way or not from the beginning, it is what Moscow has done. That's why we used it as the example. The people are like flocking there. I mean, by hundreds, especially during COVID, in a very small town, random place, because they've read the blogs and they've seen some of their media, right? And they want that. And then the people, you know, when a MSNBC is running hit jobs on them about being a theocracy, it's going to reject all the wrong people are not going to come. So they've got this right. Very good balance. You want something like that that's appropriate and adjusted for your particular fortress and project. But that's the basic idea. And then it's sort of on the beacon point or kind of that as being, I guess this is the third side of all this, is like it also has an effect, I think, on the outer culture of your enemies, undermining them as well, because of Cliff can get into that as well, some Thucydides for us. But so it has multiple effects, but we just see it as a necessary, you know, function and posture. Have this fortress.
Yeah, the interesting thing with screening is it's natural, it's normal to every organization, institution. This isn't controversial for the sake of controversy. It's just rethinking your screening process. And two tools I've found useful are jokes about certain topics or just mentioning in passing certain authors. So, you know, new person in our community, you just mentioned offhand, I was reading Doug Wilson the other day. And just watch their face either melt or light up, or maybe they don't know, and that's totally fine too. But you begin to just it becomes part of your screening process as you're talking to people. Well, I want to give Cliff a chance to kind of advocate at the end, and I'm hoping it ties into the last question. If it doesn't, no problem, because I need to do a whole episode on this anyways. It's the question of normies, because you talk about identifying a population that is critical to your enemy and find a way to acquire their loyalty. The big question a lot of us are asking. One, can normies be one? Because, you know, it's up for debate. And then how to win them? Because you cast a vision at the end, come with us if you want to live. So I'm wondering if that might play into it. So Clifford, why don't you take it away from there?
Yeah, well, of course they can be one. That's why the whole concept of being red-pilled comes from, right? Someone who's red-pilled was a normie and now they're not, right? And it just means that they've come to see something that they didn't see before. And I think for a lot of people, it's not some new abstract concept that they learned about. For a lot of people, it's reality that hits them in the face. And I think that's what the negative world, if nothing else, is. But for a lot of people, they can be black-pilled when that happens, you know, especially if they're disconnected from any kind of community. They realize, oh man, we just lost our building, or oh man, I just got fired from my job because this, that, or the other, and I'm isolated and now I'm hopeless. And so what we can do is for people who are insecure or in any kind of way, whether that's they're not really sure, they find themselves self-censoring more and more, and they're starting to find their own opinions starting to change, right? And they're worried about that. Strong fortresses like Hillsdale, like Moscow, Idaho, people are flocking to because they feel safe there. They don't feel safe out in the open, isolated. And so, you know, if you're in a situation where you know, you were sending your kid to the same public school that you went to as a kid and you liked it and it was fine. And then something crazy happens and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't do that anymore. Well, it turns out maybe there's a classical school down the road that you can send your kid to. And you realize now, oh, that functions as a kind of fortress where I can be secure. So the normies certainly can be one, in a way we were all normies once, in the article, such as
these.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, the two examples from Thucydides that we mentioned in the end of the article there, just talk about being really strategic in where and how you build these fortresses. And that might, I don't think that's something that people are used to thinking. You know, again, in the marketplace of ideas, you don't consider the kinds of things that we're thinking about. You think primarily of where can I get the most profit? But I think we use the term currency a lot too. You have to change the currency, the thing that you value, the thing for which you're willing to trade other things for. And that will sort of shape your thinking for, you know, where should you invest your time, your treasure, your worry, you know, all of that. So, yeah, the normies certainly can be won, but they have to be won strategically. And, you know, people like yourself, Chase, who picked out a certain place to plant a church, you know, I think especially in large cities, that's probably not going to be a prevailing strategy for most people. I don't know if that's going to work anymore. I think about the example of the King's College that failed in Manhattan. And to look back at it now, it just seems like a foolhardy enterprise to begin with. But of course, that wasn't the case when it was founded. That was a different world then. But I think looking back now, I'd say, it's not worth my trying to save that institution because there's no way that they're going to be able to stand up against the cultural forces of Manhattan. And I know because I lived there for 3 years and I felt completely assaulted all the time from just living in a morality that was contrary to the one I was seeking myself. So anyway, that's the lesson there. Come with us and live. Yeah, find yourself somebody who's building something that's turning into a fortress and join them.
Is kind of the like with, we can go back to the blogging or whatever, like your outward facing bit is where people who are not already looking for you would notice you or would hear about you. It's like when, you know, we would do in all kinds of military campaigns America's had, you know, you fly over and drop propaganda leaflets of, you know, well, life is better over here, you know, come. And that's the basic strategy is pulling people away from, you know, it is in a sense red pilling them, but just calling them to a better and higher life, even if they're not fully oriented yet. And the more people you pull away from your enemy, from their kind of stock of reserves and these things, the weaker they become, right? And their position becomes less and less defensible. And maybe, I mean, we use this analogy from the video games again, you know, there's one strategy to winning some of those games. That's like, even if you can't develop a massive city, you can kind of establish through smaller structures, enough cultural reach where you eventually overwhelm, you know, your opponent. You just control, they no longer can have a stable society. I mean, like Total War, you can recruit priests that go into theirs and like disrupt and they implode. Anyway, that's like the idea is, you know, and call just always kind of, so in this sense, you know, you can say it's got like an evangelistic aspect to it, but you're calling them to the fortress. It's not this thing of, you know, we're convert them and now just send them back into, you know, the middle of Manhattan. Like who wants to live there? It's awful. I mean, as Cliff, now you'll literally be assaulted, not just morally assaulted. Who wants to send their daughter to a college in the Empire State Building? Like this is just, it doesn't make any sense in hindsight, right? But it's like, that's just not a good strategic move. Call them, you know, to where you've already established a defensible position, you know, offer them the better things you're trying to achieve and invite them to join in. So there are you can see like vestiges of all the cultural strategies before that there's still something to them that they're alive, you know, that bit is kind of like a, you know, a seeker sensitive aspect. Like you're still saying, this is better. Come, you know, join us. Right. You're still a culture warrior because you have a martial spirit and you're against you're not bashful about it. But you've also adapted these things to negative world and it's taken on a new form. So.
Excellent. Well, this was great. Yeah. I'm convinced that there's more normies out there, than most people believe. The radical left makes up a fringe of the population. Of course, it seems to be growing and that kind of thing. But if you can have an organization that is aligned at the top and has strong border policies and understands what they're about, people are drawn to that self-assertion. And we're seeing a lot of wins here on that regard. You know, it's a smaller town than Manhattan or that kind of thing. Anyways, I could turn a whole defense into why I'm still in Boulder, but I'm not going to do that. But my encouragement to many pastors, like there's a lot more normies that are easily winnable if you strive for excellence and pursue God and say, come with us if you want to live. So I thought this was a great article. Thank you guys for spending some time with me to kind of dive into it. And I'll put a link to the show notes. So thank you guys for joining Foolproof Theology today.
Thanks, Chase.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's good to be here.